I'm Ron Barr, and welcome to this special U.S. Airways in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA. Sports Byline is America's sports talk show and heard on more than 200 U.S. radio stations, Sirius XM satellite radio, as well as worldwide on the Internet and the more than 500 stations of the American Forces Radio Network. On this special in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA, we'll talk baseball with the Dominican Dandy Hall of Fame pitcher Juan Marichal. He was one of the most dominant pitchers of his era. We'll talk to him about his career and his participation in what most people call the greatest game ever pitched. Also, did you know there was an Israel Professional Baseball League? At least for 1 year there was, and Aaron Pribble pitched in that league. He talks about his on-field, off-field experiences in his book called Pitching in the Promised Land, a story of the first and only season in the Israel Baseball League. And Carmen Policy will join us. Policy is an attorney by trade, but through his childhood friendship with the DeBartolo family, he became the San Francisco 49ers' top executive in their 5 Super Bowl winning seasons. He shares his stories about the team, Joe Montana, Bill Walsh, his close friendship with owner Ed DeBartolo Jr., and the NFL. So sit back and enjoy this special in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA. First up, Juan Marichal. Marichal, along with pitchers Bob Gibson and Sandy Koufax, dominated baseball during the 60s. With his above-the-head leg kick and pinpoint control, he threw a no-hitter and twice led the National League in shutouts, including 10 in 1965. He broke in 1960 with the Giants, throwing a one-hit shutout against the Phillies, striking out 12. The kid from the Dominican Republic, who came to the United States not speaking any English and almost went back home because he was homesick, threw 244 complete games. On July 2, 1963, Marichal was involved in what has been called the greatest game ever pitched. He and Warren Spahn dueled for 16 innings in a scoreless game before Willie Mays won it in the bottom of the 16th with a home run off of Spahn. But I began our chat asking Marichal about the special connection and love affair between the Dominican Republic and baseball.
Well, we love the game of baseball in my country. Those days, you know, the kid wanted to become a baseball player. Today, I think they have a good reason why they want to become a baseball player, because they can make so much money and their life can change from night and day. When I signed my first contract as a professional baseball player, I got $500 bonus. Today, some kid from Dominican Republic, 16 years old, can get $4.6 million. So you can tell the difference. Also, baseball is number one sport in Dominican Republic. Everybody wants to play the game. You go to Winter League in Dominican, you go to the Caribbean Series, either with Dominican, Puerto Rico, Venezuela, or Mexico. In those countries, baseball is like bread and butter, you know, and we love the game and we love to play it. And that's why you see today so many great players from our country, so many prospects in the minor league, and so many superstars.
Tell me about your first baseball glove. Do you remember it?
Yes, that was made of some material that was very, very funny, you know, because most of the players there at that time, at that level, we don't make glove. We make that kind of first base mitt. And this is how we learn how to catch the ball, because we can't afford to buy a glove or bat, even a baseball. We used to make our own baseball and bat. We used to climb in the trees and cut a branch and let it dry, and we make our own bat, and this is how we learn how to play the game.
Take me out on the field as a kid growing up. What were those ball games like in the Dominican Republic among the kids?
Crazy, crazy. Oh, yes. A lot of rivalry, you know. We take the game so serious that when I played for the Dominican Air Force in my country, one time we went to my hometown to face a team in Monte Cristi, and we lost a doubleheader. That Air Force team was owned by Trujillo's son, Ramfis. And Trujillo was a big dictator in Dominican Republic. So we lost that doubleheader. We came back to the city. Ramfis ordered a commission to go investigate in Monte Cristi why we had lost a doubleheader. So until they came back, they threw everybody, the whole team, in jail. The manager got 30 days, and all the players got 5 days. So that's how serious they take the game in our country.
And the story is, did you pitch against his team, beat them 2-1, and then he liked you so much, he wanted you on the team, and you had to enlist in the Air Force at the same time.
A year before that happened, I faced the Air Force team. I beat him 2-1, and the next day was a lieutenant and the door knocking on the door with a telegram that say, be at the Air Force right away. So, oh my God, I took that telegram to my mother, and she didn't know what to say. So about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the same lieutenant came back with another telegram that read the same, and she said, "Well, son, you can't say no to those people."
Tell me how you got scouted by the Giants. How did you end up getting signed?
Well, this man, he used to play baseball at the Negro League team. One of those teams was owned by Alex Pompeth, a gentleman that worked for the Giants as a scout for Latin America. And he named this man Horacio Martinez a bird dog in our country. And he started looking for players, and he ended up signing the Alou brothers, myself, Dennis Rivas, Elias Sosa. He became one of the biggest or better scouts in our country. And that's how I became a Giant.
What did you know about San Francisco?
At that time, nothing.
I mean, I can understand. And how old were you when you signed with the Giants?
18. Yes, I signed September 16 of 1957. So it was a few days. My birthday is October 20th. So it was about 20 days before I reached the 18.
And so you leave the Dominican Republic, and where did you come to in the United States?
The first stop was Sanford, Florida, where the Giants have the minor league camp. I spent like a month and a half there. Then from there, I went to Michigan City, Indiana, Class D, where I pitched 245 innings. I strike out 246. I went 21 game in the regular season, 2 in the playoff. I ended up with 1.87 ERA. I think I won all the pitching department that year. So the following year, they moved me to Class A.
One of the things that I've heard from Orlando, your teammate and fellow Hall of Famer, and from other players that came from the Dominican Republic and Puerto Rico, when they came to the United States back in the 60s, it was like culture shock. And even the story is that you were very, very homesick, that you almost went back to the Dominican Republic. How hard was that transition for you, Juan?
Very hard, very hard. You know, I left my country for the first time. My mother, my sister, and two brothers, I came to spring training, and let me tell you, I was shocked when I got to Sanford, Florida, because I didn't know about the racial problem in this country. So I said to myself, I couldn't believe it. The greatest country in the world and have this difference with human beings. And I almost went back because of that.
What was the first time you ever ran into racism?
Right there in Sanford, but and driving all the way from Florida to Michigan City, we had to ride in the last seat of the bus, right in the back. And was my manager's name was Buddy Kerr, a guy that played baseball for many years for the Giants, and he became like a father to 4 black on the team and 3 Latin. Every time we stopped for gas or for food, he was sure that we got something to eat. So he used to take us from the back of the restaurant through the kitchen to have something to eat. And I never forget that. I think that stopped my intention to go back home and forget about baseball.
How hard was it to play the game when you had these type of distractions? Because A, you're young, B, you're in a foreign country almost in a sense, and you're trying to perform, and yet you've got to deal with all of this.
when I was on the mound, I forgot everything about it, everything. I just want to do good. I prepare myself physical, mentally, to do good on the field. And I think that's why I made it, because I played the game to win. And I think everybody that play any sport should play to win and never give up. And I was that type of person, you know. I sacrificed myself for my career.
Orlando told me one time that a lot of the Caribbean players learned English by watching television. Was that true?
Well, when I came to the state, I can hardly say a glass of water. I remember going to a restaurant, and I used to look to a different table to see if I see some plate that I might like. So I used to point to that table and tell the waiters. I think the first words that I learned was same, same, same. I used to point to the plate and I say same, same. So that way to know what I want. So it was very hard, very hard. But the way I learned little English was I bought a English and Spanish dictionary. And in the bench, I used to sit with near some American player that I can hear them talk, and I can learn more by talking to Philippe or Mario or Jesus, because when we were together, we only talk Spanish.
What about your style of pitching, that high leg kick? Did you develop that as a kid? Because it stayed with you all throughout your career. Where did that come from, Juan?
Well, when I started to pitch, I went to a town named Monte Cristo, my near hometown, and I saw this man pitch named Bombo Ramos. He used to play for the national team in Dominican Republic. So when I saw him pitch, he became my idol, and I want to be a pitcher like him. And he used to throw like Don Drysdale, nothing but sidearm. So I started to imitate him. And my first 2 years amateur, I pitched nothing but sidearm. I came to United States. My first year was sidearm. And my second year, right before the season was over, Andy Gerber come up to me one day. Andy Gerber was my manager. So he came up to me one day and say, "Juan, why did you pitch like that?" I said, "Well, that's how I learned. I don't want to go through the story about Bombo Ramos." So, but then he kept asking me questions, so I have to tell him about Bombo Ramos. So I said, "Andy, was a pitcher in my hometown named Bombo Ramos that used to pitch sidearm, and I saw him pitch one afternoon, and I fell in love with his style. And he became my idol. That's why I throw like that." So he said, "Do you want to learn how to throw overhand?" I said, "What would be the benefit if I do learn?" He said, "Well, you will be much better pitcher against left-handed hitters." Right away, I said, "Yes, I want to learn." So he took me to the bullpen with two baseball and a catcher, and I tried to start to throw the ball overhand. I never did it before. So at the same time, it seemed impossible to do it without kicking my leg. And that day, that leg high kick started thanks to Andy Gerber.
Did anybody coach you along the way when you came in? I mean, you were pretty much set in your style. And the one thing you were certainly known for, aside from the high leg kick, was your pinpoint accuracy. I mean, you didn't walk very many people. And I'm just wondering, when you came into professional baseball in this country, did people try to tinker with your pitching motion?
Well, I got a few tips from my oldest brother when I was pitching in Dominican Republic. Then when I went to the team, the Air Force team, was a coach there named Francisco Pichardo. We call him Biruta. And on a rainy afternoon or rainy day that we didn't play ball, he used to take all the pitchers to the mound. And he used to throw the ball with such a pinpoint control. And he used to tell every pitcher, he say, "Do you know, I don't have too much speed, but if you can throw the ball on that spot, you can pitch anywhere in the world." And you know, he was right, because After I learned how to pitch, and I tried to copy what he say, you know, to throw the ball in the spot where the hitter don't hit it with too much power, and try to hit the catcher gloves, I think you're gonna end up being a great pitcher.
You had a deadly combination, the high leg kick, but you also, did you not, throw from different positions with your arm. Overhand, sidearm, three-quarter arm. And that combination, I would think, would really throw off the rhythm of the hitter. Was that by design, Juan?
Well, I heard that from many hitters, you know, after they faced me. After I learned how to throw overhands, I have the chance to go overhand, three-quarter, sidearm. Like, sometime when I got a right-handed hitter in two strike, I used to drop down and throw a sidearm. Because I know that the right-handed hitter didn't like that style. They don't like the ball that came from that direction. So I think I have the advantage of by learning how to throw overhand, and now I can go three ways. One time a writer say that I can throw 13 different pitches. So I think I only control five, but I think it was talking about all the direction, all the way that I used to throw overhand, three quarters, sidearm. So you can count a different pitcher. You can throw fastball, sidearm, fastball, three quarter, and fastball overhands, and the rotation on the ball is different.
You made a very impressive debut in the major leagues, July 19th, 1960, Philadelphia Phillies. Tell me about the game.
Well, I come up in July 10, and Tom Sheehan was the manager. And he come up to me and say, Juan, you got to be prepared for July 19. You're gonna face the Philadelphia Phillies. You're going to pitch that day. In between, I just want you to throw batting practice. So I was getting ready, you know, for that day. And the day went by, and July 19 come up, and I was ready for that game. I remember throwing the ball in the bullpen, and they was announcing the lineup. When they come up to my name, I got goose pimple, you know, and I feel funny after they mention my name. I feel very funny, and I say, if I feel this way, I don't think I'm going to be able to pitch. So I went to the mound. I threw the seven regular throw that they allow you to do on the mound before every inning. And I still feel the same way. But when I saw the leadoff batter, everything went away. And I was able to throw the ball. And lucky enough, I pitched one hitter.
For everybody, it was a one-hit shutout. He only walked one, and he struck out 12. What was the pitch that Clay Dalrymple hit?
You know, Tom Sheehan and Orlando Cepeda, he was my interpreter. So they come up to the mound, and they pinch hit Clay Dalrymple, you know, and they say that this guy's a pretty good fastball hitter. So don't throw him nothing but curveball. So the first pitch I threw, he hit one over the second base, and that was the only hit. But I followed the rule. I threw what they told me to throw, but it didn't work.
You mentioned about the game being different, and certainly a part of the game when you were pitching, Juan, was intimidation by the pitchers. I mean, Bob Gibson was a very intimidating pitcher. You were a very intimidating pitcher. It seems like it was a dichotomy to your personality. You were an easygoing, lovable type of guy. How did you pick up the intimidation factor?
Well, I learned through the years and watching other pitchers like those guys you mentioned, Gibson, Drysdale. That you have to learn how to throw in and out. And if you're throwing two pitches outside, you have to show that hitter that you can come in. And because if you pitch one way, I think they can get you. But if you make those hitters think a little bit, they don't know where the next pitch is going to be on the zone where you want that pitch to be. So I used to brush hitters sometime, and the sometime that batter that I brushed back, they want to chase the mounds. But you know, when that happened, Orlando was always next to me. So the hitters, they say Orlando, they see Orlando so big next to me, and they say, oh no, I don't go over there.
Pete Rose said you were the best pitcher that he ever faced, and even Bob Gibson paid you a very strong compliment as well. He said, I had a better fastball and slider. He said, but Marichal was the best of our time, better than Koufax and better than me. That is a high compliment, sir.
I think so. Came from one of the best. Gibson was awesome. I used to love to watch him pitch. He was a great competitor. And a guy that when he was on the mound, he mean business. He know that he want to win. And the only way is by competitor and being tough. It's not all the way that you can be a great pitcher if you don't throw the ball the way he used to.
But was it a badge of courage to pitch a complete game? I mean, I think about today with the specialization where, you know, you have the setup guy, you got the closer, middle reliever, but you guys did not want the ball taken out of your hand, did you?
Well, those days, when they give you the ball, they expect you to go nine innings. And I used to love to go nine. I think when if you're not tired, I think you should go nine. You should try. And the only reason that you can develop a strong arm is by throwing. If you don't throw nothing but maybe 60 or 80 pitches or 6 or 7 innings, your arm don't going to be strong enough when you try or you have to go nine. I think you have to do it. Gaylor, myself, you know, we used to work so hard and we used to complete so many games, and we never have an arm problem. Never.
Juan Marichal has joined us on Sports Byline USA, and as I mentioned, he was part and involved in arguably the greatest game ever pitched involving him and Milwaukee Braves Hall of Famer Warren Spahn. The date was July the 2nd, 1963 at Candlestick Park. The two great pitchers matched scoreless innings until the Giants outfielder Willie Mays homered off of Spahn to win the ballgame 1-0 in the 16th inning. I think before we talk about that game, everybody that's listening around the world should understand what Candlestick Park was like to pitch in. What kind of park was it for you and for Warren that night?
Oh, that was, to me, the way the game went, and you know, it was easy for both of us to pitch in that park because we went 15 innings. We threw over 200 pitches. I was lucky enough to become the winner. But let me tell you, it wasn't easy to pitch against the great Warren Spahn, a left-hander, the winning left-hander in the decade, you know, the 363 wins. And he was tough. He was tough as a pitcher and as a batter. He was a good hitter. And pitching at Candlestick, I used to enjoy it.
That ballpark was windy, and that's what I was getting at, and it could get very cold in the middle of summer. What was the night like? Did that help out as far as both of you being able to pitch that long?
I concentrate so hard in that park because every time I hear that the hitters complain about the wind and the dust and the this. So I say to myself, if they don't like it, you know, I have to think that it's a good place for a pitcher. So I have to concentrate on that and forget about the weather, forget about the wind, and just try to do your job, throw the ball where you think it's going to affect the most the hitters, and just concentrate on that. And I think that's what I used to do when I was on the mound.
When you think about the fact that it was Warren Spahn, the great lefty, and it was the great righty, Juan Marichal, pitching against each other, was there something about that competition between the two of you in that game that added to the kind of the rush for both of you pitchers?
Well, Alvin Dar wanted to take me out of from the ninth inning on. And I went to him and I begged him to let me stay on the game, you know, and I say the weather's nice. I feel strong. I don't know about the weather, if it was nice or not, but I just say that for him to keep me on the game. So he let me stay for 2 innings or 4 innings. So now the game is on the 14 innings. He came back to me and said, "That's it. You're not pitching any longer. I don't want you to hurt your arm. I don't want nothing to happen to you." So I say to him, "Mr. Dark, do you see that man pitching over there? He's 42 years old. I'm only 25, and nobody gonna take me out of this game." So he was mad. You know, I should not say that to him because he was my manager, and you have to have some respect for your manager. But I don't want to leave the game. And Ed Bailey was catching on that game here. And every time that Alvin wanted to take me out, he said, "Don't let him, don't let him." Win or lose is a great, great, great game. So in the 15 innings that I went out, when I came back, I say, "Alvin, that's it. You can get somebody else." So he called the bullpen and get somebody ready. And when Warren went in, he got just 3 out, just like that. And I look at my glove, I look at my hat, and I look to the bullpen. I saw the relief pitcher coming in, and I run to the mound. So they have to call that relief pitcher back to the bullpen. So lucky enough, I got 1, 2, 3, and before I get to the dugout, I wait for Willie to came from center field, and I say, "Chico, Alvin Dark is mad at me, so I don't gonna be pitching any longer." So he tapped my back and say, "One, don't worry, I'm gonna win this game for you." So he was the leadoff batter, and at that inning, and first pitch, that ball left the park. I was the happiest man in earth.
I bet. 1-0 the final as Willie Mays hit the home run in the 16th inning to win it for the Giants and Juan Marcio. And again, I want to urge you to check out this wonderful book. It's called The Greatest Game Ever Pitched, Juan Marcio, Warren Spahn, and the Pitching Duel of the Century. I think it's easy to say that there were a lot of great hitters playing baseball when you were pitching. And I think of people certainly like Frank Robinson in the National League, Roberto Clemente, Pete Rose, Billy Williams as well. Tell me about some of the hitters then and the battles that you had with some of the great hitters in the National League.
Well, so many, like you say, so many good hitters at that era. I remember Will Stargell. I remember Billy Williams. Those guys, you know, Pete Rose. He was something. Roberto Clemente, and a guy from the Dodgers that broke his ankle, Tommy Davis. He was a great, great hitter. And everywhere you go was Lou Brock, Maury Wills. That guy, I think I don't want to see that guy come to the plate because if he get on, he can extend a walk to a triple. And with so many tough players at that era that when I see, I hear people now compare that era to now, I think that the only difference now is the money that the player make because those days was hard to pitch or hard to hit. And you have to play the game to win. And I think the game was played differently at that time.
Warren, I've had a lot of great pitchers tell me the same thing, that the big boppers, the big home run hitters, really did not bother them that much. It was those little pesky contact hitter guys, the guys like Tony Gwynn, and you were talking about Tommy Davis and others like that. But, I mean, were the contact hitters the ones that used to drive pitchers like you crazy?
Yes, yes. And I can mention one that I try so hard to get that guy out. And every time he was at the plate, he gave me some hard problem. Was Tony Gonzalez. He was one of those guys that hit the ball left field to the middle, or sometimes he pulled the ball. But I have such a hard time to get him out. And one time after we both retired, you know, we played this legend game in Miami where they have all the Cubans. So I was invited to play in that game. And I think I was playing for Amendares, and he played for Havana. And I got him out. And I told him, I said, listen, it took me 25 years to do it, but now I'm happy. I got you out.
Juan Marichal, deserving of his Dominican Dandy nickname and being in the Baseball Hall of Fame. Staying with baseball, Aaron Pribble is now a school teacher, but he also has been a professional baseball player. One of the stops in his vagabond minor league pro playing career was in the Israel Baseball League. He played in the IBL for only 1 year. That's because 1 year is all the Israel Baseball League existed. That 1 year was full of baseball goofiness, interesting teammates, playing conditions, fans, and a life-altering experience. He shares it all in his book, Pitching in the Promised Land, a story of the first and only season in the Israel Baseball League. He talked wistfully about what he learned in that year about his love for baseball in a troubled part of the world. But first, I asked him what he thought most people expect out of a book like this.
That's a good question. I think some people are really interested in the baseball angle, and some people are really interested in the fact that it's in the Middle East. So the way that I like to conceive of the book is Bull Durham in Tel Aviv. It's got all the Bull Durham stuff. It's got all the baseball stuff and the antics that you would expect, but it's America's pastime in the Holy Land. And because of that, it makes for a really weird combination. Things like Dr. Ruth, the sex doctor, throwing out a first pitch at a ball game. When does that happen, you know?
Let's go back to your baseball career a little bit, the one in the United States. Tell everybody what that background is, Aaron.
Well, I started playing right here in the Bay Area. I got a scholarship to pitch at the University of Hawaii. Pitched 4 years out there. My senior year ended up leading the team in ERA, and I did not get drafted. Everybody's got a story about why they didn't or what happened, and so I went out and tried to make it work in the independent leagues. And at the end of that summer in 2002, I hooked up with the Sonoma Crushers of the Western League and ended up playing for one of my boyhood idols, Kevin Mitchell, and that was a heck of an experience. Yeah.
When did it come to an end for you, baseball in this country?
I played 2 seasons of independent ball. One for the Crushers and then one in the South in Jackson, Mississippi and San Angelo, Texas. And then I played one summer in France overseas.
What was that like?
That was an incredible experience as well. It's not really professional baseball, but they can have like 2 or 3 foreign people per year. You can't have a pitcher-catcher combination. So basically you can have one American who's either catching or who's pitching or something like that. And, you know, like everything in Europe, it's a little bit different. So they take a vacation in the middle of the summer. People just stopped playing baseball for 6-8 months, and that was so foreign to me. But at the same time, it's a great way to see the world.
I had a friend of mine that played professional hockey in France, and he said he knew it was a different game over there. He said between periods, the players would be smoking and drinking wine.
Exactly.
And he said when they take off their uniform pants, he said they had silk shorts.
Right. A similar story like that. I'm dining with my roommate but his dad out on this farm, and I got a pitch that day. It's a Saturday. And so we're there having lunch, and right as we walk in, my buddy, of course in French, whispers to me, now my dad's going to serve wine, and if you don't drink it, he'll be really offended. So I'm sitting there. I know I got a pitch in like 2 hours, and he's pouring me the Chardonnay or the Pinot or whatever, and try pitching with a few glasses under your belt, you know?
Tell me a little bit about baseball in Europe. We know what it's like in Japan, and we know what it's like in Korea. We know what it's like in the United States, of course, and then down into the South American regions in the Caribbean as well. But what about Europe and over in the Middle East?
They're trying really hard to grow baseball in Europe. And as a matter of fact, Major League Baseball Europe is really starting to do some cool things. They've just had their first 3 players sign professional contracts out of France in the last couple of years. I was just over there visiting some old teammates about 3 weeks ago, and they were telling me some neat stories about how guys are just starting to get signed. In Spain, the baseball's pretty good. In Italy, it's pretty good as well. In the Netherlands, France is so-so. You know, they have the European Championship every year, in which I played when I was there in Germany, in Cologne, Germany. It's doing all right. You know, I think that there's so many places to tap, as we've seen with the NBA, you know, in the basketball game, that I think they're really trying to look there for some talent.
In the Middle East, the only baseball I know of is the Little League teams that come out of Saudi Arabia and come to Williamsport, Pennsylvania, to play in the Little League World Series. Anywhere else in the Middle East is it played?
Nowhere. Nowhere else. And, of course, those are mostly American guys who are playing. We had grand hopes of starting it in Israel and having it spread to maybe the West Bank or Palestine or to Jordan, those places. But to my knowledge, it's just Israel.
Tell me a little bit about how that league, the Israel Baseball League, got started.
It was the brainchild of a businessman on the East Coast named Larry Barris. And he was well known for the cream cheese filled bagel. He was Jewish, and he created the cream cheese filled bagel and had some success with it. And he wanted to spread joy to the people of Israel because he was a huge fan of Israel through the game of baseball. He loved baseball. He thought, I'm going to combine two of my passions, baseball and Israel and the Middle East, and I'm going to put them together. And so he thought, what the heck, let's make it work.
And it only lasted, what, the 1 year, 2007?
It just lasted that one year, a couple of months, for better or for worse. It was a heck of a ride while we were there, but it ultimately had some financial difficulties and had to fold. However, they've tried a couple of times. It seems every other year they keep trying to start the thing back up again. So there were some rumblings just this year that they were trying to find some financial backing to do it again.
Aaron Pribble is with us in the studio. We're talking about his book, Pitching in the Promised Land, a story of the first and only season in the Israel Baseball League. For you, this was a journey, and I'm not talking about climbing on an airplane and going to the Middle East. This was really a kind of find-yourself journey, because I saw in a story in which you said that you were unsure of your talents and uncomfortable with your heritage when you began. Your mother is Jewish. And so tell me a little bit about that uncomfortableness.
Absolutely. I don't know if uncomfortable is the right word, but certainly unsure. My mom's Jewish and my dad's not. So my grandma, my dad's mom, was born on a ranch, on a cattle ranch in Arizona. So we'd go there every year. I used to ride horses, got the cowboy hat and the boots and the whole deal. Both of that is part of who I am. So my brother and I like to refer to each other as the redneck Jew boys kind of deal. So Israel was really the intersection of my religious and my athletic identities. I had never had a bar mitzvah, but I still identified as being Jewish, or at least part Jewish. So I really got to explore who I was, not only as a baseball player, but also as a Jew. I'd kind of scraped the bottom of the barrel of the minor leagues. I knew I had had some experience there, and I was kind of Jewish. So I got to go to Israel to explore both. So certainly a journey of self-discovery.
It's one thing, as you know, Aaron, to scratch an itch, and I'm talking about the baseball itch, but it's another one to be realistic, especially when you go into that part of the world. So I'm just wondering, what was it that triggered your decision to go over and take on this adventure?
No doubt. Well, I think we all have dreams, and some of us get closer than others. My dream ever since I was a little kid was to play professional baseball, and I had reached that dream to an extent. I had played parts of two summers. It also helped that since I had hung up the spikes and got a real job since I was teaching, I had this summer vacation. So I was actually in Hawaii visiting my old coach, who's this short little Japanese guy, and he told me about this league being started in Israel, and I kind of thought he was joking. I thought he was giving me a hard time because I'm a bigger guy and we like to give each other some fun. And I went back and I looked at this league, and I thought, you know what? I've got 2 months in the summer. The first thing I did was I pulled up the schedule, and then I pulled up my teaching schedule, and I realized it was sandwiched right in between my summer vacation. So I thought, I don't have a better idea. You know, for 2 months, I'm going to go out there and try to play.
What did you expect it to be like, and how was it similar to or different from it?
I didn't really have a whole lot of expectations going into the thing. The league did a great job on the front end work. They had 6 teams and team names and jerseys and tickets. They had a draft held on ESPN. Jeremy Schatt was the reporter and the guy who led this draft. And I forget where I was drafted, but it certainly wasn't first for my team. And they had a lot of good press coverage leading up to it. So they had done a lot of really good stuff. It was getting pressed in the New York Times, for example. And so I thought there was a lot to be excited about. When they announced that these players from the Dominican were coming out, I knew that the league was going to be legit, or at least somewhat legit, because we could have filled the entire league with Dominicans. There's some really good talent there.
What were the facilities like?
The diplomatic answer or the...
No,
or
the honest one.
Okay, let's see. There were ultimately 3 baseball fields in Israel, one of which was legit, was a very good field. It was tended by these missionaries from Texas. And so it was pristine, a beautiful, beautiful field called Hayar Cone. That's the best thing I can say about it. Our second field was a converted softball field, and which meant they had to move the fence up the hill in right field, so you had to run up the hill. But that also meant that the light pole in right field was now in front of the fence. And so, you know, they were worried about guys running into it. So what's their answer? They literally duct taped a mattress to the light pole in right field. And of course, they had a warning track, but instead of the warning track being right near the fence, the warning track is halfway in the outfield now. And of course, it's softball dimensions, so it's not a skin infield. We have some grass, but instead of changing where the dirt on the infield is, they just move the bases back to right by the cutout. So That's the second field, and that was on a kibbutz gezer. Now, we only started the season with two fields. The third field was supposed to go right outside Tel Aviv, called Sport Tech. However, they ran into some problems because where they were planning on building the field was cherished soccer ground. These African immigrants and people who would come out on the during the weekdays to play were incensed. They were irate. They were apoplectic that they were going to build a baseball field on their turf. So there was a, literally and figuratively a turf war. And the mayor of Tel Aviv, who was just recently elected, had to intervene, and they ultimately decided to build the field 2 weeks into the season.
Sounds like some stories that Tommy Lasorda told me when he was managing down in the Dominican Republic. He said when it would rain down there, he said they needed to get the game in, and he said that they would have to dry the field. He said so one day, he said they put gasoline out there on the field to try to dry it, and it burned down the outfield fences.
That is really funny that you mentioned that story, because in the book, In Pitching in the Promised Land, we do the exact same thing. There's a chapter called Rain Out in the Desert. We show, but it hadn't rained for months. It hadn't rained since we've been there, but the field is soaking wet. I mean, there are literally puddles all over the infield, and we're thinking, what the heck happened? Did it rain at night? We had no idea. Turns out that the sprinklers had been turned on somehow, because Friday mornings, of course, we played 6 days a week. You can't play on Shabbat. Of course, you can't play on Shabbat. So Friday mornings, we had to play early in order to get the game in. So the sprinkler system was malfunctioning. What are we going to do? We had to get the game in. My buddy Nate Fish and I go try to find the gasoline from the concession stand, drag it out to the field. We were apprehended midway through, and needless to say, we didn't set the field on fire, but I know what you're talking about.
We're talking about a wonderful book called Pitching in the Promised Land, a story of the first and only season in the Israel Baseball League with the author. How informed are Israelis about the Jewish people in general over there about baseball?
Very little. They're not well informed. And this is actually a good time to bring up that a documentary was made about our summer called Holy Land Hardball by two guys, Brett Rapkin and Eric Kessin. It's a phenomenal documentary. And one of the things that's interesting about it is they interview ordinary Israelis. And the most common response by Israelis were, baseball? We don't have the sport in Israel, you know, or something like that. So not well informed. Sports like basketball and soccer, I think, are maybe more attuned to the pace of Israelis and their attention span. So for that reason, games were seven innings instead of nine. And initially, we were going to start counts at 1-1, you know, instead of 0-0. That would have been insane. I'm really glad we didn't do that. Seven innings were fine. But what happens when you're tied at seven innings? You can't go to 12, 13, 14 innings. So games were settled with a home run derby, believe it or not.
Tell me a little bit about the attendance. What kind of attendance did you have at the games?
On some days, like opening day and the All-Star game, we had several thousand people in attendance. We had TV crews. We had stands, chairs to fill extra people, standing room only, you know, little kids running up and down the sidelines, behind the fence, chasing balls. It was real baseball. It was legitimate baseball like you'd find anywhere in America. You go to a minor league park, and this would fit right in. However, the normal game, Tuesday afternoon or something like that, when you're in Bet Shemesh and the Ra'anana Express are playing the Petah Tikva Pioneers, maybe we have 19 people there. Maybe, you know, so not well attended outside of those big events.
What did they charge for tickets?
That's a good question, and I'm not sure. $5? This is a total guess. This is you know, bald speculation.
Obviously, they didn't paper the house.
No, they certainly did not. And, of course, you know, I don't know much about the business plan. That wasn't my angle. That wasn't the story that I wanted to tell. But ultimately, how are you going to generate revenue, right? So ticket sales were a big part of that equation. Speaking of ticket sales, on opening day, you know, how do you charge? Do you take the ticket stub? Is there a turnstile and you go right through? They didn't really have those details worked out, especially on opening day. Afterwards, after that first game with the thousands of people, fans are mobbing the field. They're mobbing players. A guy's glove gets stolen. Some equipment goes away. And guys were scared about a terrorist attack. So guys came back to where we were staying afterwards, and they said, guys, we could have been hurt. There's some security concerns that we need to work out. And the very next day, we're approached by some of the league administrators, and they talked to us about security. They said, you guys need to watch each other's back. You know, this is a large group of Americans that's high profile. You're in the Middle East. Some people might know you're here. And we all kind of collectively looked around and went, oh, man, this is maybe more serious than we thought.
Also, you mentioned about Dr. Ruth. I'm trying to picture this in my mind, little Dr. Ruth, because she is very small.
Yes.
You know, out there. Tell me a little bit about her.
It's unbelievable. Well, it turns out I'm starting the game, and it's in Tel Aviv, and Friday mornings, it's the one early game of the week. So, you know, as baseball players, you kind of end up being like a night job. Like, you're working a night job, you rise late, you work late, whatever.